Good morning and welcome to MTSU on the Record. I'm Jenna Logue, and we're coming to you from the campus of Middle Tennessee State University in Murfreesboro, Tennessee, and the studios of WMOT-FM. Today we've got a bit of an Irish folktale for you, and our own little leprechaun, Dr. Jan Hayes, is here to talk about it. Enough with the corny accent. She has written her second children's book, Wise Una, an Irish folktale. It's illustrated by Bobby Dawson, and as was her first book, The Split-Tongued Sparrow, which was an Asian folktale. And it's going to be the first in a series, as I understand.
We hope.
Okay. Dr. Hayes is a professor emeritus of educational leadership at MTSU. Our husband is Coach Dean Hayes, the track and field coach here, multiple award-winning track and field coach and member of the MTSU Sports Hall of Fame. Welcome back, Dr. Hayes.
Thank you. It's nice to be here on this warm day.
Oh, warm indeed, and many more to come, I'm sure. I read Wise Una. It was delightful, and so are the illustrations, and Una is wise indeed. How did this folktale come to your attention?
I've always been interested in folktales, and I have a passion for traveling. So whenever I travel, I try to collect stories from the countries that I visit. In addition to that, I have taught children's literature, books and media for children, for about 35 years. So children's literature has always been of interest to me. This particular one I found on one of my trips to Ireland. And then when I came home, I read many of the folk tales of Ireland that I had collected, but I had a book of collected folk tales by William Butler Yeats, and his version of this story also sparked my interest. But I have been to the Giant's Causeway in Ireland, and the rocks are just so unique. So I had many pictures of this story in my mind before I even started writing it.
How does this differ from the William Butler Yeats telling, if at all?
Oh, it's quite different. It's much shorter to hold the interest of children. Yeats also includes Una's sister as another giant in Ireland. He also includes a part of this story, this particular story, where Finn McCool, when he's chasing Cathulain away from the house.
And we should define who these characters are.
Finn McCool is the husband of Una, mm-hmm. and they are two of the giants of Ireland. Mm-hmm. Cathulain is supposedly a giant from Scotland who has been beating up all of the giants of Ireland. And after Una outwits Cathulain, Finn chases him away. And a difference from the Yeats version is that Finn scoops up a bunch of dirt, a clod of dirt, and throws it at the fleeing Cathulain, but misses him, and the clod of dirt lands in the North Sea. That clod of dirt happens to be today the Isle of Man, and the clod of dirt that was scooped up is the largest lake in Northern Ireland. There are other minor details that are different, but not too many.
It has to remain on that child's level. About what is the age range for children for understanding the book?
I would say 5 years old up to third grade. Mm-hmm. One of the nice things about folk tales is their longevity and their interest at almost every age level.
Mm-hmm. With children being absorbed with computers and video games and text messaging these days, can you get them to sit down and pay attention to a story from a hardbound book?
Well, that's another appeal of folk tales, I think. Since folk tales have been passed down by word of mouth from one generation to another, they have a cultural influence, but they also have a moral that is sometimes not, that doesn't jump out at you. Sometimes it does. But they also represent emotions and feelings of people that, sometimes the computerized versions can't get to. In putting together the folk tales, I always try to add, if not a dialect, at least some word choices that are typical of the culture, to add to the interest maybe of learning more about a country.
And the illustrations in this book, as they were in The Split-Tongued Sparrow, are so vivid and colorful. They jump right out at you. The kids, I think, are really going to be awestruck by the illustrations. Tell me a little bit about Bobby and how you came to know him and find him.
Bobby is just a marvelous illustrator. And I met him through O'More College of Design, the publisher. Excuse me a minute. O'More College of Design in Franklin, Tennessee, the publisher of this particular book. At the time we met, he was a student, and one of his professors recommended him to me. So I gave him my sketches of the first book, and he drew pictures, the illustrations from my sketches. And in The Split-Tongued Sparrow, you'll notice that the colors are a little subdued while they stand out and are very clear. They fit the culture of Japan with the mountains in the background. This time I asked Bobby to do the illustrations with the jewel tones. Having traveled to Ireland, I wanted the vivid greens and the bright colors. And I had seen many of the illuminated texts that the monks had done. So I wanted the illuminations to come through and the Celtic design. But I also wanted the roughness of the characters to show through. So Bobby and I worked together a number of times before we were both satisfied with exactly what the illustrations came to be.
Rough but still kid-friendly, not scary.
Absolutely. And Bobby is a kid at heart. And his imagination is fantastic. He also did a good deal of research on the clothing of people from years and years ago. So you'll notice that Una's shoes are clog-type shoes, and the rough-hewn clothes of both Finn McCool and even rougher look of Cuchulainn from Scotland.
There was a concern for historical accuracy or cultural accuracy in both books. I guess what stood out to me about The Split-Tongued Sparrow, the starkness of it is in the action scenes in which the mean woman expresses her nastiness to the sparrows, and the sparrows toward the end express nastiness back at her. There's a sort of a sharpness about those pictures that really depicts the friction going on there. And this book, Wise Una, is all about conflict, but it's about how a potential conflict, but it's really more about how Una helps her husband avoid the conflict than anything else, by using her brain instead of there being actual physical confrontation.
A very wise woman figuring out how to outwit a bully. And that's very appropriate to our times, I think. But at the same time, she not only outwits the bully, she gets the bully to do her honey-do list of jobs. While they're waiting for Finn to arrive, so to speak.
Why isn't her husband that smart? Why is she smarter than her husband?
Well, perhaps he was tired from building the Giant's Causeway.
Okay.
I like stories about wise women. I have always been entranced by an author's ability to cleverly bring out the thinking of women.
And isn't it interesting that kind of feminism, if you will, survives in an ancient centuries-old folk tale from times that we would think of as far more restrictive and chauvinist in its treatment of women, and yet there's something about the wise woman that comes through even in the oldest stories.
And I'm researching another right now that they have given me go ahead to get started on another one, a story from Ghana about Anansi the Spider-Man, the Ashanti natives, and their stories, and I found a wise woman to be the wife of the Anansi the Spider-Man. And as he comes across challenges, she's the one who gives him the idea of how to solve the situations.
Yeah. Do you find that not only in terms of being entertaining for kids, but do you feel a certain responsibility to keep these stories alive, because they don't seem to be passed down from parent to child the way that they were a few generations back?
I'm not sure that I agree with you on that one.
So you think the oral storytelling tradition is still alive and well?
I do, and perhaps in this country we hear more of Paul Bunyan, Pecos Bill, some of the other tall tale heroes. So if you go to Ireland, you'll learn the children there know about the folk tales of their own country, and I think that's also true in Ghana, where I hope to do the next one. And I'm even looking ahead to the possibility of doing a Cherokee Indian tale, a folk tale. And certainly there are lots of good Native American folk tales.
Mm-hmm. In each of the cases of all four of these ideas, two of which have found their way into books and two not quite yet, we're talking about indigenous peoples, aren't we?
Yes, we certainly are. And I think that's where the story of people, the morals, the values of people comes through in their storytelling.
Do you find any analogies between these types of folk tales, even though they don't have any direct connection to a religion, and biblical parables, or indeed stories that come through in any other kind of religious text, insofar as their ability to teach a moral is concerned?
That's an interesting comparison, and there are professors who use parables just as the beginnings of lessons that they teach. There's one here on this campus that does that. Mm-hmm. And I think that if people were more careful about talking to children about values, using stories as a base, that would come through even more. But it might be why storytelling is so appealing to everybody.
Mm-hmm. What is your experience with your own kids been like? Would they rather hear mommy tell them a story than to hear it told by a teacher or to read it themselves? Or is it just the other way? Would they rather read it themselves and then feel like they're discovering something?
I think it varies with each individual child. My own children were avid readers. And you may have looked at the dedication. It's to my two daughters who throughout their lives loved books. And as I taught children's literature, I would bring books home and at all their different ages, and they would read them and we would discuss what those books meant to them. And that helped me get a perspective of how they interpreted what they were reading. Mm-hmm. But it also opened up, and to me this is the value of any of these books, conversations about, well, what do you think? or in our beliefs, in our religion, this is what we think, mm-hmm. or what I think. And it kept lines of communication open throughout every age level for my girls.
Mm-hmm. My mother, when I would ask her to read me a story, she'd always say, read it yourself, because she figured that was how I would learn how to read. But and I did. I loved to read by myself. But there's also something, if you're talking about atmospherics, just very warm and nurturing about sitting on your mother's lap as a little kid, feeling her body warmth against your body warmth, and feeling her arms around you, and reading the story to you. It's an expression of affection as much as it is the communication of an appreciation of words and pictures and grammar and stories and that kind of thing.
Well, I believe that fathers and mothers ought to read to their children before they're even born. To build a pattern of the language.
I don't see why not. I mean, they make a big deal out of having the right music on in the background, yes. while the child is in utero. Why not read to the child while it's in utero?
Exactly. And the sound of the voices, the rhythm of the language. And when my children were very small, they often, as you said, sat in my lap while we read, or right next to me with our arms around each other. Mm-hmm. But I would always put my finger under the words as I read them. Mm-hmm. And both of my girls were reading fluently by the time they were 3 years old.
Mm-hmm. If you read something to a little kid and you make an emotional connection with it, don't you find that the kid retains the information, not only the story itself, but the parts of speech and so forth, longer if there is if he or she can associate that story or that book with a positive emotional feeling, that doesn't it just last longer in the brain?
I agree with that, and I think that's part of the brain-based learning theory, that emotion ties, and especially positive emotion, ties to enjoyment. Mm-hmm. of that particular activity.
Mm-hmm. And that's why it's good to get this from somebody who you feel secure with. It's part of that security feeling. My mommy or my daddy or my uncle or my aunt or my grandma cares enough about me to tell me about this. But then, grandma, if she's just telling it to you, passing it on from generation to generation, she can't give you Bobby's vivid pictures. It has to be theater of the mind. It has to be her imagination to your imagination making that connection.
That's part of it. But another appeal directly of the children's folk tales is that, as you said, they come from indigenous people, they come from common people. Mm-hmm. And so there's often a harshness in them, mm-hmm. but they work themselves out. They tie up nicely. So children are exposed to the harshness of life mm-hmm. through a story, but at a comfortable level.
In an age-appropriate way, not
yes.
a way that will give them nightmares.
Exactly. And then they see that through thinking and positive behaviors, things work out in good ways. Mm-hmm. The three billy goats Gruff is a good example of that mm-hmm. happening exactly.
That troll down underneath the bridge, who's that trip trapping yeah. across my bridge?
And the vocabulary, the words, the harshness mm-hmm. That the troll comes out. I've got two horns mm-hmm. that are spears, and I'll poke your eyeballs out your ears.
That's scary stuff.
And I've got two stones. I'll ground you to bits, body and bones.
Mm-hmm. Well, the witch shoving Hansel and Gretel into the oven.
Yes.
I mean, you know.
and yet, it's at a safe level.
Right. Don't you find a lot of, not necessarily all of them, but a lot of children's storybooks, the text is onomatopoeic. You've got a lot of clip-clops and typed out sound effects. When you would read to your kids, would you go with the sound effects and kind of get, you know, goofy with it and be, be that kind of an actor? And would your voice change as you changed from character to character?
I've done that, but I'm a storyteller, too. I actually teach how to do storytelling.
Mm-hmm.
So I would do that, but sometimes when my daughters wanted, or children that I was around teaching, wanted to hear a story a second time, I'd say, now this time you have to be. So they became the characters, and then they would use their imagination with the sounds and the words. But as I've been researching the Ghanaian folk tales, they actually use sound, the sounds, as a Nazi is going through the tall grasses, it's swishy, swashy, swishy, swashy.
Uh-huh.
So they'll use the sounds, actual sounds that occur.
But instead of, when you tell it, instead of going swishy, swashy, you might go swish, swish.
Exactly.
You actually make your own sound uh-huh. effects like they did in the golden days of radio.
Right, and as a Nazi is digging a hole for to catch the Osebo, the leopard of the terrible teeth.
Mm-hmm.
As he digs, we'll say,
You do get the
like
grunts in there.
Like he's digging
yeah.
the dirt up. So, and that's very typical of their particular storytelling style.
Mm. I think that's the best way to do it. You turn yourself into a bit of a clown in the process, but it's for little kids, and it's all it's all in a good cause, and it just doesn't it's just not the same if you just read it through kind of dryly and everything.
Mm-hmm.
You've got to put a little bit of the ham actor in there, don't you?
And the so important on folk tales to present the culture.
Mm-hmm.
In the Split-Tongued Sparrow, it was translated back in what I had written was translated into Japanese.
And you've got the Gaelic language version in two pages in the back of the book.
Yes.
Of Wise Una.
Exactly. And in this book, you'll see the dropped caps and the illuminated letters. You'll see on the inside the front cover in the fly pages in the end sheets the design that Bobby did of the stones from the Giant's Causeway.
Mm-hmm.
And even the food that Una cooks for Cahoolin will be typical Irish fare.
The bread that he
the flat bread
eats and bites
mm-hmm.
into much to his chagrin.
Uh-huh.
After, and not that the bread was bad, but you'll have to read the book to find out why Cahoolin has a problem with the bread. It's all part of Wise Una's careful plan. When do you anticipate your next book coming out?
They take about 2 years.
Really?
From inception to completion. So I would expect it'll take a couple of years for the next one.
Okay. Now, these are very small books, as you might imagine, as they are children's stories. Why does each book take so long? Are you just being meticulously careful to be historically and culturally accurate, or is there something else about the process?
I think that's part of it. All the research and the care that we take, we have to get an accurate translation, so we have to make a connection with someone who can do the translation, and the text has to be exact in order for that to happen, so that has to all be approved.
Mm-hmm.
And then as Bobby and I have worked, we have to work together so that we both agree on every single page, on every single picture, on the type style that we include, the colors that are represented.
Mm-hmm.
Even as you look in the home, I wanted the home to be with the wooden floors.
Right.
So maybe it's meticulousness, but it's getting together and working through every detail that we put into them.
Well, that's part of actually doing justice to the story and doing justice to the culture. If you don't do that, if you don't do it that way, then it's you kind of leave yourself open to people saying, well, you just viewed it through your own white European eyes or whatever,
yes.
Instead of respecting the authenticity of the people you're talking about and the people you're describing.
And that's one of the reasons I like to use or write or adapt folk tales from places where I have visited too, mm-hmm. To breathe in the air and look at the trees. You'll see that Finn McCool strips down a fir tree to use as a walking stick. And so there had to be fir trees in the area of the Giant's Causeway. Right. So to keep everything as accurate as possible.
It just wouldn't be the same if you tried to tell the story without actually having been to the country, would it?
Well, some people do it, but I find there's an advantage to just walking on the stones, or and maybe it just becomes more ingrained within by visiting these places.
Do you ever have to go back over your text while you're writing a children's story and stop yourself and say, well, that word is too highfalutin for the kids, or conversely, I'm talking down to them. They're smarter than that. I mean, how do you maintain that kind of balance?
Gina, I have never tried to do a story to eliminate a large vocabulary. I think children are bright. Mm-hmm. And most children can figure out the meaning of a word from the contextual clues.
And you could use it as a teachable moment. If they don't know the word, then you could use that. You could stop at that point in the story and say, okay, now look at the characters. What are they doing? You know, and then you can figure out from that what that word means.
And often the stories that I've written are ones that I've used in storytelling. Mm-hmm. So I get reaction from children or even adults that come to my, you know, when I do storytelling. Mm-hmm. And I get their reactions to my expressions or phraseology. Mm-hmm. So that helps in the writing as well.
When you are writing, do you find, even as a grown-up, a college professor with a PhD, that you have to access your inner child?
Absolutely.
Does little bitty Jan come out when you're writing?
I don't know if little bitty Jan comes out, but mischievous Jan comes out. And I believe that a sense of humor is so important in writing children's stories. And even not just writing them, but Bobby Dawson has a marvelous sense of humor. As you look at the characters, mm-hmm. With Finn McCool in his mop of yellow hair.
That looks like my oldest nephew. That is exactly what his hair looks like.
And it falls down over his eyes. Mm-hmm. But he's been away from home for a long time.
Right.
At the beginning of this story.
It looks like Bill Walton did when he was playing for UCLA, except Walton's hair was red.
You're right. And in one place, Finn McCool has a magic finger, as do most of the giants in Ireland.
Yes.
And so when Bobby actually drew a picture of Finn getting a sense that Cahoolan was on his way, Finn's thumb is in his mouth. That's his magic finger.
And I noticed that you didn't make Una a stereotypical redhead, which you could have done, you know, with an Irish woman. She has dark hair. Was that intentional? Or
that was Bobby's choice. We talked about it, but since Cahoolan is going to be a redhead, we didn't want the two redheads in it.
Right.
And I noticed there are lots and lots of dark-haired women in Ireland, mm-hmm. as well. So, yes. So that was a choice that Bobby and I agreed on.
She's beautiful, but she doesn't look like Maureen O'Hara, if that's what you were thinking of. You know,
no.
throw that out. Okay. Where can people get a copy of Wise Una?
Right now they can get it from the O'More College of Design. It will soon be on Amazon.com, mm-hmm. and I'm sure in the very near future that the MTSU bookstore will also carry it, as they do the split tongue sparrow.
O'More is spelled O apostrophe M O R E, a good Irish name, and it is located at 423 South Margin Street in Franklin, Tennessee. Call or write to them, or keep checking Amazon.com and your local bookstores, and you will find it there. It's Wise Una, O O N A G H, an Irish folk tale adapted by Dr. Jan Hayes and illustrated by Bobby Dawson. Thanks for coming back, Jan.
Thank you. It's my pleasure.
This is MTSU on the Record. I'm Jenna Logue. Join us again at the same time next Sunday. Don't forget, you can check out the podcast at your leisure at mtsunews.com, and we're also available on iTunes.